I am Elner Helene, and I have lived in Moorhead about 43 years, I think. My childhood days were spent in Mackville, North Dakota, and from there I went to college, and I taught school at Oslo, Minnesota, and I came to Dilworth, Minnesota to teach, and came into Moorhead to get a summer job, which I did get at Fairmont Foods. And it was while I was at Fairmont Foods, which was then Fairmont Creamery, I met Paul Urine. Paul Urine was one of our city salesmen. And I would like you to meet Paul now. And Paul, do you want to tell us a little bit about, maybe about your early grandparents first?
Okay. my grandfather, Amon Urine, came by boat, of course, from Sweden in 1880, from the province of Värmland. And he was the oldest son of that particular family, and he immigrated to the United States. And while in Sweden, he was an apprentice in the plastering business, which was followed out when he got over to this country. And I'll talk a little more about that later, but in this was 1880 that he got here, and my grandmother arrived at the same time, and my grandfather and a guy by the name of Gus Dirksen, they come a little different route, and they stopped in Minneapolis, and this Gus, got a little hungry, so they went into a store, and he asked the storekeeper for some oast. And the storekeeper come along with a little package of oats for him. Well, of course, that wasn't right. Over in Sweden, they called cheese oast. So I finally got that straightened out. But that happened in Minneapolis on the way to Moorhead. And my grandmother, she come directly to Moorhead by the NP Railroad. And then in 1881 in October, Reverend Calvin Cavillin of the pastor of the Swedish Lutheran Church married this couple. And that couple, there was five girls and four boys that were born, and there was one that died in infancy. And my father, Oscar, was the oldest of the eight living children, and it turned out that in the years going by, my father and grandfather went into partnership in the plastering business, which was a big business in those days. And my father married Lily Staples in Wadena, and then there was three of us born to that family, myself and Wayne, who passed away in 1915, just short-lived, and my sister Helen, who's been a resident of Moorhead ever since, and a former librarian at the Moorhead Library. Now then, getting back to the plastering business, like I said, my granddad and father were in the business together, and they plastered buildings within 100-mile radius around here. And then my father had a kind of a special technique of his own, what they did, they called drawing cornice in those days, and that was putting in fancy columns and buildings and fancy ceilings. And he did this in various local buildings, and he traveled as far as Enid, Oklahoma to put in these fancy ceilings. And the only one that I can recall now that is still the building that's still standing with some of his work in, which was done during the winter of 1923 and 24, is the lodge room at the Elks Club in Fargo. And that was a big project. That's a big room up there. And of course, since that time, the plastering business has passed away into drywall and all that, so that business has kind of gone by the board. Then getting back again to the early days,
Before we say that, maybe he plastered a few other houses. He plastered that one where President Dubry lives in, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. I was going to bring that in a little later.
Oh, okay.
But this Hontoon house, which is on the corner of 8th Street and 7th Avenue South, where President Dubry of Concordia now lives, it was known as the Hontoon house. And they plastered that, and of course the roof that was put on that in that particular era, that was imported from England, and it was very outstanding. I'll go back again now to about 1881. This is when the city of Moorhead was incorporated, and it was a mayor-alderman form of government, which we still have here. At that time, the city was divided into three wards, and in that era, they started the first hospital association. It was formed in 1881, and that was known as the Darrow Hospital, which was down on 7th Street and 7th Avenue. It was on the corner there where Concordia, since that time, has built some housing units for their students. And that lasted until they built the first Northwestern Hospital up on the north side, which down through the years did some business. And then in the early 20s there, the Franciscan sisters from Little Falls purchased it, and they changed it to the San Ansgar. And then a few years later, they built a new hospital and renovated the old one, got rid of that. And at that early date of 1881, Mr. Bruns built what he called the Grand Pacific Hotel. Now, that was on 8th Street and the former Great Northern Railroad, which is now, of course, Burlington Northern. He built a structure there. It was made all out of wood, and he called it the Grand Pacific Hotel. It had 101 carpeted rooms in it, and had both hot and cold running water, and it had gas lights. Now, he built that building for a cost of $150,000, but that building didn't last long, and in 1896, that building was torn down by James Hill, who at that time was a head man of the Great Northern Railroad. I can't say what the particular reason for him tearing it down was, but that's what happened. My grandfather in 1901 and to 1903 served as one of the aldermen in Moorhead. At that time they had three wards, and Moorhead at that time was known as the wickedest city in the world. They had gambling and houses and bars that were open all night. In fact, they even had 15 liquor licenses at that time. That was back in 1901. And
now, on the alderman, that Lou Hontoon was on the alderman, was an alderman too, wasn't he?
Mr. Hontoon was one of the aldermen.
And also Jake?
Who?
Jake Kiefer?
Oh, the old Jake Kiefer, yeah, the present Jake Kiefer's father. I don't recall who else may have been on there at that time.
Now you can tell us maybe a little bit about your own early childhood. I think that trolley story is kind of cute.
What?
The trolley story.
Well, as kids we used to have a lot of fun in which is known as the Bloody Third Ward. That's the northeast corner of the city. Well, we had streetcars in those days, and during the summertime on 5th Avenue and 10th Street North, they had a guy wire that held the telephone pole in the proper position that held the trolley for the streetcar. But then It went back about a half a block, this guy wire, and old Nels Olson, he used to park his dray wagon back there. So about four or five of us, when the street guard come along to make that corner, we'd jump and grab the guy wire, and of course that shake the telephone post, and the trolley would go off. Well, then we'd jump off and run around and hide behind the barn while the man put the trolley on. So that was one of the incidents with that streetcar business. And then in the wintertime, the streetcar would stop, maybe we'll say on 10th Street and 2nd Avenue North, and let a customer off, and then we'd hook our big piece of sheet metal on there with a rope onto the cow catcher, and we'd slide on the snow up to the courthouse. In those days, of course, there wasn't any paving. 10th Street didn't get paved till about 1923. And speaking of 1923, we used to have a baseball field on the corner of 8th Street and 1st Avenue North, and we used to occupy that practically every evening, and all of a sudden one day we come to play baseball, and there was equipment there. They were starting to dig a basement, which in turn turned out to be the Fairmont Creamery. So we lost our baseball field.
What about your turning bridge on 1st Avenue? The turning bridge on 1st
Avenue. Oh, yeah, the 1st Avenue. There's still the pilaster down. You can see that when the water's low in the river. There's a pilaster down there where they used to have a turning bridge, so the boats between Moorhead and Winnipeg could get by. In fact, at that time, too, I will mention that the first boat that was built in Moorhead to ply between Moorhead and Winnipeg was called the Pluck. And as I understand it, they used to haul grain and lumber and all kinds of things back and forth.
Well, then I think you should tell us a little bit about Ross Freeburg's father had a...
Oh, yes. My uncle... Ed Freeburg, who was married to my dad's sister, Olga, he had a grocery store on Center Avenue, or in those days it was called Front Street, and it was in the 700 block, which would probably be about where the American Bank has a parking lot now. Now, this store was a good-sized store, and it was really up-to-date in those days. And he used to have pedestals in the store where he used to display the fruit, different things on. And I used to work for him as a kid. I used to put up pecks of potatoes and do quarts of vinegar and milk bottles and all those kind of little odd jobs. And this store was, like I said, real outstanding. All the people from Fargo that owned big businesses over there, like the Delandreses and the Moody's and those people, they all had come to Moorhead to do business with Uncle Ed. And these ladies, Mrs. Delandresy and Moody, they'd come over in their electric cars occasionally and place their order. But as I recall it, they never took the order with them. You had to deliver it for them. And my uncle had two grocery rigs, one of them for Moorhead, which was pulled by a single old horse by the name of Duke. And over in Fargo, he had a team of horses on that, black ones. And you couldn't put a weight down because they'd take the weight right with them and take off. So it wound up, he used to have a driver and a delivery man on that wagon, so that somebody to hold the horses while the boys were delivering the groceries. This store was, it was really up to date, and it most popular store in Fargo and Moorhead in that era.
Then you used to help, was it another uncle that you used to try drive cars to Duluth?
Oh, and Duluth? I had an uncle too, Uncle Jim, that he was... car salesman with Doyle Motor Company. Doyle Motor Company in Fargo was the area distributor. He had the whole state of North Dakota for the distribution of Hudson and Essex cars. And during the summer months, we were just a bunch of kids, of course, going to high school. We would leave here on a Monday morning and in an old-style Hudson limousine, and seven of us would go up there, and we'd get these cars from the dock. And they used to ship these automobiles by boat, of course, from Detroit to Duluth, and they were shipped by cubic foot. So in order to save money, they'd put the bumpers and stuff inside the car, and then when we'd pick them up at Duluth, we'd have to put the bumpers on. And normally we would stay in Duluth overnight, but then as time passed on, we got a little itchy about staying there, so we'd either drive to Aiken or probably even as far as Brainerd. And during the entire summer, we used to make an average of three trips a week up there. We'd go up back up on Monday, back on Tuesday, up on Wednesday, and back on Thursday, and up on Friday, and back on Saturday. And it
then that was during high school days. And during high school days in the fall, then you played football, is that right, with the Moorhead Spuds?
Oh yeah, we played football. We had the Schill brothers, Bill and Clayton, and old Goldie Anderson, of course, and my cousin Pete, and Chris Holson, and a bunch of those fellows on the team. And during the 27 and 28 season, we had a very good season both years. We were undefeated.
Then your next step was Fairmont Creamery, wasn't it?
And then the last year or two, I started working at Fairmont in 1926, I think it was, as a special delivery driver. And we'd get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and get the ice cream packed in salt and ice and haul it over to the depots so it could be sent out to little towns like Castleton and all those little towns out in North Dakota. And then a little later on, they come along with these ice cream bags where you could just put the 5-gallon cans of ice cream in the bag and put the cover down, and it would stay nice and hard until it reached its destination, which was a lot easier than the other old method.
Then tell us a little about the knocking man.
Well, after I went through the process of being a special delivery driver and a wholesale driver and a retail driver, and then I was route foreman for a while during the time that Fairmont changed over from horses to automobiles. Mentioning these horses, they used to have out on the Fairmont farm there, they used to have about 30 horses out there, and every morning they'd bring about 20 of them in to run these 14 or 15 routes that we had, the retail routes in those days. Of course, the wholesale routes was all done by truck, and it was quite a transition from horses to automobiles, because you couldn't train the automobile to go around the corner and meet you on the other side of the block like you used to be able to do with the horses.
But then you were also the knocking man, weren't you?
Oh, the knocking man business. That come after I was wholesale sales supervisor. We used to go around and walk up to the house, knock on the door, and we'd say, "Do you have any Fairmont products in your refrigerator?" Well, if they did, well, I'd go in and I'd give them a gift or a prize or whatever you might want to call it. And if they didn't have it, well, they got nothing except hoping that they would have Fairmont products in their refrigerator the next time we come around.
Before we leave Fairmont Creamery, which later became Fairmont Foods, one of the reasons for that was because they had so many frozen foods, wasn't that right?
Oh, yeah. Fairmont was the first company in this area that handled frozen food products. And the first one we used to have was strawberries. And then it developed into all the vegetables like peas and all the kindred ones. And I was going to mention, I probably got a little ahead of myself here, but I was going to mention that Fairmont Farm, that originally was what they called the Huntoon Farm. And that was out in the area where the I-94 now, I would say, crosses that farm approximately in the center. And Fairmont at that time out there, they had 135 or 40 Guernsey cows, and they used to sell this Guernsey milk at a premium over the regular standard milk. And this particular product had a special cap that covered the top of the bottle with a clamping ring on it to make it look superior to the standard milk, which of course it was. And then mentioning that farm, that, like I said, it was originally the Huntoon Farm, which we mentioned the house that they lived in up on A Street there. Huntoon was, besides being a farmer, he was a general business tycoon, shall we say. And Fairmont bought the farm in later years after Huntoon had died. And right along with that, I used to have a little side thing out on the Fairmont farm. I used to have 40 hives of bees out there where I produced honey for myself, and I used to put it up in smaller containers, and I'd trade it into the grocery stores for groceries, and that way I kept my overhead down.
And Jack Rood was with you on that?
No, Jack Rood started a little later, after he seen how I was getting along. And, of course, in those days, there was a lot more sweet clover than there is now, so you got a lot better production than you do nowadays. Nowadays, the bees are more or less depending on sunflowers and the likes of that.
Before we leave Fairmont Foods, I think we should talk a little about the whistle.
About who?
About the whistle.
Oh, yeah, after Fairmont was built and got into operation, they used to have a whistle that blew at 7 o'clock in the morning, 12 o'clock at noon, and 1 o'clock, and then again at 6. And that went on for, I don't know, years on end until the last couple of 3 years they were in business, they stopped the whistle, and it was quite a letdown for the citizens of Morehead, who had been depending on that whistle for years on end to be sure they got to work on time and got their meals on time. Well, there used to be a fellow by an old Charlie Kell. He had a couple of boys, Bob and George, that worked for Fairmont. And old Charlie was a house mover, and he went by the whistle. And at 7 o'clock in the morning, his breakfast had to be on the table, and he had to eat at 12 o'clock noon, and likewise at 6 in the evening. And so that whistle meant a lot to the citizens of Morehead.
Yes, I heard a lot of people complain when the whistle stopped blowing. From there, you became a city assessor. Now, tell us a little about your new ideas on taxation.
Well, a little prior to that, though, I was on the city council for about 12 years, and I worked with mayors Rudy Berglund and Ralph Hollins and Sliv Nemzik. Under Hollins and Nemzik, I was the vice mayor of the city. And we had quite a good council. We used to run things pretty much on the way it should have been run. And then, I think it was in the later 40s, we got to where our artesian wells in Morehead were kind of drying up, and we had to put a new 16-inch water main from Morehead out to the what they call the Schroeder Farm, which is about 2 miles east of Dilworth. And that was a 16-inch line, and we had a water and light man by the name of Joe Young. He was the instigator of it, and he found that there was quite an aquifer out in that area, so he thought this would be a good place to tie in. And to this day now, they're still using that. And of course, the way the city is growing, they do at times in the summer have to pump a little water out of the river, but that's not too frequent as I understand it now.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to say anything about the new ideas you had on taxation under the city assessor?
Oh, after I was on the council, I decided to quit. Well, then at the same time, the boys on the council, they wanted a new assessor, and being that I was leaving the council, they thought they should have me do it. So I took the job on for a couple of years and kind of straightened out the assessment roles and tried to equalize it the best possible. And I even went to St. Paul to find out how the guys at the state did it, so I could have some basis to work on. And I did that for 2 years, and then I went into the Ben Franklin business, which is a variety store business, and that was located in part of the Comstock Hotel, which was on 8th Street and Center Avenue. Comstock Hotel was, I don't know how many rooms they had, but on the ground level they had their lobby and their dining rooms, and I might say there was columns in that hotel that was put in there by my father. He used to make imitation marble along with his other work. And then there was two retail stores there. Stan Wold had the Wold Drug there for many years, and I was next to him, and that was part of the hotel. And of course there were hotel rooms above our retail establishment, so that was part of Moorhead in those days.
Now, when you had the Ben Franklin store, we should mention a little about you. In the meantime, while this time went on, you were married, and your wife, Mrs. Urine, helped you a great deal in the Ben Franklin store. Now, tell us a little bit about her when you were married, and who she was, and so forth.
Well, Frida, my wife, was Frida Knutson. She was a more Fargo girl. Her father, John Knutson, and John Lee, they owned the Northwest Bakery, which is in the west end of the same block that I had the Ben Franklin store in. And in fact, that's where I first become acquainted with her. And then we had a daughter named Pauline, and then Frida used to help in the, after Pauline grew up, I should say, she helped out in the Ben Franklin store, which I ran for 7 years, but due to the changes in this type of a business, I found out I didn't have enough square footage to properly display everything, so I closed out the business. And
now, Harriet Whitcomb worked with you too, Harriet?
Harriet Whitcomb, known now as Harriet Froland, she worked for me as a cashier and clerk in the store. And then later on, when I got into the laundry and dry cleaning business, she was my head girl in that business.
Tell us a little bit about that ValClean that you used in the laundry business.
I started out, well, after our daughter grew up and got married, my wife, she wanted something to do. And so we rode around in this coin-operated dry clean or laundry business was a coming thing in those days. And so she thought that'd be pretty good, so she wouldn't have it was so you wouldn't have to be around there every minute. And so she decided she'd kind of take on a deal like that. Well, let run along for a few months. Well, then the coin-op dry cleaning come along. So I had to get into that too, and that worked pretty good for about a year or so. And in the meantime, I had established a place in Hawley, and then a little later on, I bought a building in Barnesville and tore that down, put a new building up there, and started one there. And as time progressed, these dry cleaning machines, they use what they call perchloroethylene. And it was a good dry cleaning solution, except you had to dry the garments at 186 degrees, which you had a possibility of getting some shrinkage. And you had to wash that pretty close. And at that time, I went into that, and I got into the whole professional deal along in these three establishments where we did the pressing and the whole ball of wax, so to speak. And then a little later on, they come out with a Valclean machine, which was made over in Italy. And AI DuPont Company was the makers of the Valclean, or the technical name of fluorocarbon. And this was, to my idea, was an advancement over perchloroethylene for the simple reason that Valclean or fluorocarbon had a boiling point of 113 degrees, so consequently you could dry the garments at about 80 degrees, which eliminated all shrinkage and so forth. And at the same time, this fluorocarbon or Valclean used to make the garments brighter and the whites whiter, which I thought was a big advancement. And to this day now, there's none of the other dry cleaners have ever taken this on. They're all still using the perchloroethylene.
You did have gold stamps. Do you think they were worth using?
Well, I used to have those gold bond stamps, and the only advantage I could see to that, it helped Kurt Carlson in Minneapolis make a lot of money. It didn't help that much in the business.
Mm-hmm. Now, you did talk about your grandfather. That's Emil Urien. He was an alderman in 1901. He was chairman of the Permanent Improvement Committee, and you were also chairman of the Permanent Improvement Committee, were you not?
Yeah. During my time, that was my number one committee, and that comprised of what you might call the street department and all these improvements. And Bill Arndt at that time was the... I had him as superintendent of the street department, and Bill did a real outstanding job of keeping our city clean.
Then Emil Urien, your grandfather, was also a charter member of the Commercial Club in Moorhead.
Oh, yeah.
And you were also a member of the Chamber of Commerce. So they kind of...
Well, yeah, I was a member of the Chamber of Commerce, and prior to that, I might say, too, that I was one of the instigators of... getting the Junior Chamber of Commerce going in Moorhead, which I was a charter member of with quite a number of other fellows.
And you were also a chairman of the Salvation Army Advisory Board, of which I am also a member now.
Yeah.
You were there, you were a member quite a few years on that.
Well, I was on the, I was appointed on the Salvation Army Board of Fargo and Moorhead back in the days when the other members were Sam Stern, a clother in Fargo, and Fred Irish at the bank in Fargo, and
Leo Johnson in Moorhead.
Leo Johnson in Moorhead, and the fellow that started WDAY,
Reinecke.
Earl Reinecke. Mm-hmm. That comprised the board in those days. But now, since Elner's on it, they got 24 members. Of course, probably the business is a lot bigger. I'm not sure.
Well, I suppose. Then going on to the Elks, you're a member of the Elks, also a past exalted ruler. That's right?
Oh, yeah. I joined the Elks many years ago. In fact, at this point, I've been a member for 42 years. And... right shortly after I joined, I think it was a year, they still wanted me to go through the chairs, which I did with the sanction of Mr. Deems, who was manager of Fairmont Creamery in those days, naturally it took some company time, so that's why I wanted his sanction on it. And I followed through the chairs, which took seven years. Well, one guy dropped out in the meantime, and so it only took me 6 years to get to be exalted ruler. And while I was in the chair there, I had the opportunity of making a national plea to all the Elks to get Sam Stern as our grand exalted ruler, the head of the Elks of the entire United States. And I put a big full-page spiel in the Elks magazine, and it went over big, and so Sam got to be exalted ruler that year. And at the same time, we used to have a fellow by the name of Frank Archibald, which was our secretary and over there for 42 years, and 44 years, I think it was. And he got to be known as Mr. Elk of North Dakota.
Mm-hmm. And Harold Erpelding he was an exalted ruler before you, was he not?
Harold Erpelding, who owned Harold's Opticians in Fargo, was an old buddy of mine, too. And he was exalted ruler the year ahead of me.
Mm-hmm. Then you were also a member of the Lions Club?
Oh, yeah, I belonged to the Lions Club. And I remember one day after the meeting, they had passed out the little pins for your attendance. And Henry Steening, who was a leading attorney in Moorhead and quite a individual, he come up to me after, he was a Lion also, I might say, and he come up to me when we were walking out. He says, "Gosh," he says, "I've been a Lion longer than you do." And he says, "I don't get one of those pins." Well, I said, "The only trouble with you, Henry, you don't show up all the time."
I knew Henry Steening well, too. He was a great man. Upon retirement, then, you got a phone call from St. Ansgar Hospital and to tell us a little
about
it.
Oh, yeah, after after my wife passed away, I should say, shortly after, I got into this laundry and dry cleaning business. So then I just decided to take the whole thing over myself, and I had 9 girls working for me in the 3 establishments. And as we get back to Harriet, she was very capable, and I could leave the place and go to Europe for a couple of weeks and get back, and everything was in good shape. And what else?
We're talking about the St. Ansgar.
When you after retired. I sold all my commercial interests and sold my house and moved into a 3-room apartment, then one day Alan Nathan, who was running the purchasing department at St. Ansgar Hospital, called me up and he said, "Paul, what are you doing?" I said, "Well," I said, "nothing in particular." He says, "Come on up and see me." So I went up and saw him, and he asked me if I would help him out, and going running around to all these wholesale houses and buying all the odds and ends. And of course, being in the laundry and dry cleaning business, I was acquainted with all these fellows, so I thought it'd kind of be relaxing. So I did that for 6 years until just now, a couple months ago, when they decided that they had a mandatory retirement age up there of 70 years old, and they found out that I was only 73, so they decided I couldn't hang around any longer. So here I am out in the cold.
Yes, and they couldn't have found a better driver, and anyone who knew the city as of Fargo and Moorhead as well as you did. He's a beautiful driver.
I'd like to back up a little bit to the council days. I overlooked it at the time, but we had a young attorney in Moorhead, and I thought to myself one day, gee, that guy'd make a wonderful city attorney. So I talked to a couple of my other councilmen, and I persuaded them that we were going to do the right thing. And we had a little meeting in the back end of Ralph Townsend's grocery store, and we discussed this. So then I called up Jim Garrity, and I said, is young Jim around? No, he'll be back in 5 minutes. So pretty soon the phone rang, and Jim says, "What did you want, Paul?" And I said, "I want you to come down here to Townsend's Grocery." I said, "I got something to talk to you about." So over he come. Only a couple blocks away, so it didn't take him long. I presented the case to him, and then Jim got to be, this is James Garrity Jr., you might say. He got to be city attorney, and which he held that position for 20 years. And now he is our district judge at the courthouse.
Mm-hmm. He does a fine job. Then, before we end our little interview, you must tell us about your family that you have right now.
Well, I must say I've got a wonderful family. My daughter Pauline and her good husband Harold, who owns Harold's a car clean out here on 30th Avenue South. Harold and Pauline were in Minneapolis right shortly after they got married. He came home one day and he said to me, we visited my Uncle Vic down there, and he says, I got an idea. I was going to start a car cleaning business, clean these cars up for the dealers and so forth and so on. And I said, my goodness, that sounds pretty good to me. And he'd already talked to his father, and his father didn't think it was such a hot idea, but I pushed him into it. He started out in the wintertime in an old double garage, and that was pretty poor deal, so we moved him into another bigger building, and he made about three moves, and finally built one himself, about 40 by 80, and he kind of grew out of that because he got into the cleaning these big aluminum semis and stuff, too, and you couldn't clean cars and steam semis at the same time, so then he bought this property on 30th Avenue South and put up a 100 by 100 foot building and split it in half, and half for trucks and half for cars. And during the time, I might say that I was in the dry cleaning business, I was down to a big show in Chicago, and there was a fella who had a little 4 foot stand on there. He was demonstrating what he called the Ming process. Now, this Ming process got started in 1926. There was a fellow in Oklahoma, he bought a Chevrolet sedan, and he got tired of polishing it, and so he started working with various chemicals, and then he discovered that these automobile dealers, when they painted the cars, they used an awful lot of dryer, and by looking through a microscope, you could see that there was many pits in this brand new paint on these cars. So through this Ming process of these new chemicals and stuff, he buffed this car out of his, and he found out he got rid of all those pits and everything, and it put a more or less a permanent, shall we say, glossy finish on it. And it also helps so that during the winter time in our area, the salt doesn't get up and eats the paint away so fast. And with this process, all they got to do is wash it down and wipe it off with a Turkish towel, and that's about what it amounts to. Well, Harold's had a nice business up there. He's had as high as 16, 17 men working for him. And right along with that now, they've had a family of 5 girls and 3 boys. And the oldest girl is going on 26, and she's a X-ray technician at the Fargo Clinic in Fargo. And the second one, at the present time, she's in the medical records department over there. And Tracy, the second one, she used to be quite a basketball player for Morehead High, and volleyball player, and she even helped coach these teams for a while. And now, on the 6th day of October, she's marrying a farmer down at Hawley, Minnesota, a real nice fella, and maybe she's going farming, I don't know. And then the third one, she's a student at MS College in the
That's Terry Lee, isn't it?
Terry Lee, in the physical education department, and she also teaches or coaches basketball and volleyball. In fact, she coached the girls in Shanley High to second place in North Dakota last year, which I thought was quite commendable. And then we get down to Tim. He, at the present time, he's 20 years old yesterday, and right now he's helping his father run the business out there. He's hasn't quite settled on what his life work should be. And Tanya, who's right behind him, she's a senior in high school, and then comes Ted, who is a sophomore in high school, and then comes Tate, who's a freshman, and then Tricia Joe, who's in the fourth grade, going to be in the fifth now, and that takes care of that family. They have lake cottage and boats and stuff, which they enjoy thoroughly during the summer, and they've had their number of pets and everything, so everything has gone real good, I think.
We have to mention the oldest girl. We forgot to mention her name is Tamara. We want to have names of all these people, too.
Oh, so. Yeah. The oldest girl over at the Fargo Clinic is Tammy.
Uh-huh.
Is that the only one I missed?
Yeah, I think you got them all, except you didn't mention her name. Well, thank you so very much for a very good interview. I think it was a beautiful one.